Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal. Check out tens of thousands of technical articles on our new knowledge hub on farmersjournal.ie.
RTE Radio 1. Well, now on RTE Radio 1, time for this week's Countrywide with Damien O'Reilly.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing 295,000 readers the latest farming news and the best of rural Ireland weekly.
Good morning and welcome to the programme. Coming up between now and 9 o'clock, we discuss the future of live exports. Preserving the wild Irish honeybee, we have a report. Brenda drops by a women's shed in Wexford, and looking forward to the Six Nations with former Ireland prop John Hayes.
Text 51551, email countrywide at rte.ie and tweet at RTE Countrywide.
But first, where I am now, the sun is shining and there is a really great sense of spring. I'm walking through a field here of cows. They're out. And they're eating the grass. The grass is growing. And of course, it also means for a lot of dairy farmers around the country, the beginning of the calving season. It's going to be very busy on the 18,000 or so dairy farms around the country. And over the period of this year, over 2 million calves will be born on all beef and dairy farms. But these next 6 to 8 weeks are in particular the busiest on dairy farms. And I've come to one such farm here outside Cuff's Grange near Kilkenny to meet one farmer who is just at the beginning of the busy spring calving period. Eamon Sheehan is a young dairy farmer milking just over 200 cows here on the family farm near Cuff's Grange. Thanks very much. You can keep your mask on, don't worry. We keep them on. So I'm getting a great greeting here with all these weanlings. Busy time for you.
Yeah, getting there. We're just at the start of calving, I suppose. We're due around the 8th of February and calving has kicked off, I suppose, the last 4 days. We had our first calf on the 31st of January.
Right. And how long will you be calving for?
We have 217 cows calved, and the last of those are calved on the 1st of April is the last 2 days.
All right, okay. Well, we'll move away from the shed here.
Eamon's
father, Eamon Sr., moved from Laois to Kilkenny in the early 1970s, running a successful welding equipment company alongside building up a suckler and tillage farm here.
We're on a very good dry gravel base here, so it makes getting cows out to grass very easy.
The family are also well-known horse breeders and bred a horse last year that went on to win the World Breeders' Championship.
Yeah, we've been fortunate, I suppose, the last couple of years. There was a mare line that my father and my brother Ronan had bought originally and off Tom Brennan. And just we had very good success with her progeny the whole way through. And one of her granddaughters, Cuff's Grange Cavadora, went on to win the 7-year-old World Breeders' Championship in Lanarkin last year. In 2019.
Right. Well, we forget about last year. Really 2019. Eamon Jr. spent a couple of years working with horses in the US before returning to farm here. And in 2013, it was switched from beef to dairying.
Yeah, you know, so we started off in 2013, we milked 70 cows and we kept 60 of our sucklers also. And then over the years, we built our numbers between, you know, 20 and 30 cows a year. So I suppose the last 2 years, we've, you know, our stocking rate has improved. We're no longer buying in any replacement stock. All our stock is homebred now the last 3 years. So, we're carrying just over 200 cows there at the moment. And, it's 240 would be where I'd see ourselves in the next year or two. I suppose a couple of reasons on that. The land base that we have is very suited to it. It's very early ground. We are able to maintain 285 days of grass throughout a normal year. So, it's good ground. It's a lot easier to manage the dairy cows, I find, than the sucklers when we had them had them over the years. And it allow, you know, both ourselves, my parents, and my wife and children to have a good standard of living out of it. There's my wife and kids actually coming on the ponies, homeschooling at its finest.
Lovely.
Hi.
Hi, Lois.
Hello there.
Hi,
how
guys.
Are you?
Damien O'Reilly, that's my wife Lois.
Hi. Lois, how are you?
Okay,
and this
thanks.
Is my daughter Julia, my other daughter Rachel, and my niece Sophie.
Rachel, Sophie, and Julia.
And Julia, yeah.
See you later. Bye bye.
The expansion in dairy farming in Ireland over the past 5 or 6 years is cited as a contributory factor to a deterioration in water quality and agriculture continuing to contribute 1/3 of Ireland's total greenhouse gas emissions. So is enough being done at farm level to reduce methane levels and improve biodiversity breakdown?
Like, we have miles and miles of hedgerows here. Every year we planted extra hedgerows, extra trees. You know, we're very proud of our farm, and all that area is deducted off our area aid map, you know, and that needs to be included. I think if we include that area and we allow for the fact that that's able and capable of sequestering a large amount of carbon, then we can have a, you know, a mature conversation at that stage.
But the facts and the figures are there every year for us to see in black and white from the EPA in terms of water quality, air quality, soil quality, biodiversity loss, and agriculture accounts for 1/3 of emissions.
Yeah, and I'm not suggesting that we should have a free pass in any way. We all have to account for, you know, be responsible in our approach, in what we do. And I take it very, very seriously here. You know, we have watercourses running through the farm. They're fenced, they're maintained. You know, we don't plough anymore. It's all minimum tillage, min-till when we're reseeding. So there's no carbon released from ploughing. We've been using protected urea for the last 2 years, and we've had great success with it. And I'm very, very, very fond of it. I've had no issues. We've been using the dribble bar and trailing shoe for the last 2 years also. You know, so we're adapting to technology at every opportunity that we can.
We move from the fields to the calving shed, which will be busy for the next 8 weeks.
Yeah. So our first calf was on the 31st of January. Our due date is the 8th of February. And unfortunately, we haven't been off to the best of starts. Generally, I'd probably have a 3% loss rate on a bad year. And I've probably surpassed that already with a couple of stillborn calves. But we're lucky we have the regional veterinary laboratory beside us. They're great in there. They've tested calves for everything. So far, everything has come back negative, which is a positive, but it's a negative on the basis of not knowing what's next. I suppose the last 8 or 9 years have been very, very smooth, and I've had very little issues. So maybe it's all my good times are just catching up on me now, and we're getting rained on at the start. But look, and hopefully a bad start is half the battle. That's the motto I'm going with anyway.
Okay, and then how long do you keep the calves on farm here before you sell them? And obviously you keep some of them as well?
Yeah, well, we keep the heifer calves until 12 weeks of age. And when they're weaned and at grass, a neighbour of mine, Brian Blackmore, is doing the contract rearing for us the last 2 years. So the heifer calves go to him, usually 50 of them, in the end of April, the middle of May. He keeps them until the second winter, so they come back here in calf. The beef calves then, we have the same customers every year from we're lucky. The beef calf is a valuable asset to us also, you know.
Right.
And our Friesian bull calves are still generating, you know, between 110 to 130 euros at 10 days to 2 weeks of age.
Okay, so there is a market for the bull calves, is there?
Yeah,
still,
very much so. Like, you know, it's... I suppose.
Do they go for export, some of them?
Very few. Like last year, out of all the cows, there was 198 cows calved here last year, and 10 of them went for export.
Okay.
All the rest of them stayed for...
to be reared for beef.
By local farmers. Like, regardless of whether it's a heifer or a bull calf, you know, they have to receive the same care. It doesn't matter what they are. Like, every calf that lands here is treated, you know, the exact same way, and they have to be looked after. We can't afford for a bull calf to get sick, you know, because he's going to transmit sickness to the next calf and the next calf. And that's where the likes of colostrum is such a massive priority. You set those calves up with a good, you know, good gut health, good immunity from the very start, and you won't have any issues going forward.
Well, Eamon, we wish you the very best over the next few weeks. You've had a ropey enough start to calving 2021, but hopefully it'll get better from here on in until the end of March. Thanks for chatting to us.
Thanks a million, Damien. Good to have you here.
Yeah, that was Eamon Sheehan there on his busy dairy farm near Cuffs Grange in Kilkenny when the sun was shining, what was it, on Thursday when it was there. Big change today. He was also at pains, by the way, to point out there's not a one-man show there at this busy time of the year because he's getting lots of valuable help during calving on the farm from his friends and colleagues, Michael Dempsey, Mick Wall, Wesley Smith and his nephews Charlie and Tom, because they're homeschooling at the moment. They're knocking around as well. And of course, the boss man, as he says himself, and he referred to him there, Eamon Senior, his dad. So a busy place like so many farms across the country as we enter spring. Well, we're now moving from Kilkenny to the neighbouring county of Wexford and specifically to a place called Tom Haggart. What a great name. Now, Tom Haggart has a local women's shed who are doing their bit to keep members occupied during these tough times with various projects, which we're going to hear about now because Brenda Donoghue tipped down to meet some of the ladies who are keeping themselves busy this week. She met up first with Angela Byrne, who's the chairperson of Tom Haggart's women's sheds outside the local community centre, where, as you might hear, she was waiting for shed members to give them the likes of bird table kits and sensory quilts to take home and assemble.
Good morning, Brenda. How are you?
Hi, Angela.
Thank you so much for coming down to Tom Haggart on this miserable morning.
Something to do. Look at your boot of your car.
I have all the ladies' bird table kits and their sensory blanket kits here ready. They're all going to come and collect them this morning.
Angela, this is a great setup. Tell me about your women's sheds group here in Tom Haggart.
Yes, Brenda. Well, we're here 6 years this year. And normally we meet here on a Monday, but of course we haven't been together now since last March with the whole COVID business. After Christmas we found that there was a bit of despondency and everybody was getting a bit depressed. So we applied to Wexford County Council for a grant. We got some funding and so we decided to make some bird tables. And we first of all went to a local guy to get the kits made for the bird tables. And so I went and asked him how much would he charge for the bird tables. He came back and said he was going to give them to us free. He would be happy to donate it to the women's shed.
No way.
Absolutely.
What's his name?
His name is Dennis Moore, Moore's Barn in Kilmore here. And he made 30 kits, all sealed up in a bag, all the pieces drilled and screws and all it, sandpaper, the whole lot in the bag, which we're giving out to the ladies and then they put them together. And the whole idea of that is that when they are put together, they'll varnish them or paint them or whatever way they want to decorate them, and they'll be in their gardens every morning. The birds will come and they'll be taking pictures, put them up on WhatsApp, and it'll be a whole, what was in your garden this morning, and what, we've a robin, we've a this and that. So it was another little connection that we thought we would have.
Talk me through the importance of that connection, or trying to create that connection, and without it, what it's like.
That connection is so important, even without COVID, because it's a very rural area here. A lot of people are isolated, and so they have the women's shed to come to. But it's even more important at the moment. It's very easy to get depressed at the moment, and I think, you know, you could be feeling down any morning, and then somebody will come along on a WhatsApp or give somebody a ring from the women's shed, and it cheers you up and brings you on for that day. And sure, if you're managing from day to day, isn't that the most important thing to do? Good morning, Mary. How are you this morning?
Good morning, Angela. I'm very well, thank you.
Brought your blanket. It's beautiful. Absolutely.
It's a sensory blanket. I'm just going to make another one, if you don't mind.
No problem.
I get all the bits from you. I'm going to give that one to my sister who has Alzheimer's, and I'll make another one then for you to give to into one of the nursing homes.
Yeah, no problem. I have another kit here for you, Mary.
Oh, perfect.
Can I interrupt you here? It's Mary, isn't it?
It's Mary Doyle. Yes, it's Mary Doyle.
Mary, tell me a little bit about yourself.
My husband, who has had cancer, is getting over it. We are on a lockdown, completely locked down because of it, and I just can't afford to go out and meet anybody or anything.
So how has the pandemic been then if your husband has been recovering from cancer, and how is he?
He's fine, thank God he's fine. Mm. We're lucky that we have a nice big garden and we can just be out in the garden and do some things out there. Even walking around the drive is a good bit of a walk around, so it keeps me going.
I would say you're a very social person. Normally, Mary.
Yes.
You must miss the crack and the gathering with all your friends here in the women's shed.
Oh, you don't know how much I miss the crack. The women's shed is a lifeline for me. The women in the shed, they are amazing. They're all so talented as well. They've got such talents, but they don't keep all their talents to themselves. They share their talents out. You just have to love them all, each and every one of them. They're so gorgeous. And there's nobody that has a problem that everybody doesn't rally around and help them. Even a ball of wool. I was looking for a ball of wool, put it up on the WhatsApp. I had to wash the ball of wool in no time.
Mary, how important is that connection to each other?
Oh, it's so important. Just the mere fact of if you're a bit down, somebody comes and gives you a big hug. Oh, that is so important.
They can't now.
No, they can't, and that's the whole thing. I would just love to be down there and get hugs. I think when this pandemic is over and we all get back together again, the hugs will be mighty. The women's shed for me has been the best thing that I have ever been in my whole life.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, and you're a tonic. Thank you so much, Mary.
Thank you so much, Brenda.
You were only waiting for this moment to arrive.
Right, so Brenda, if you wouldn't mind, if you have time, I'm just going to drop this bird table down to Kay O'Riordan. She's at home minding her husband. Her husband has dementia, so she can't come out. And if you'd like to follow me down in the car.
Yeah, sure. Oh, look, you've a dog in the car.
Move over, Charlie. Say hello to Brenda, Charlie.
And I'll follow you on.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Okay.
See you in a minute.
You were only waiting for this moment.
Kay, it's lovely to meet you. How are you getting on? How has the pandemic been?
Good and bad. And I'm discovering I'm stronger than I thought I was. Brian has dementia and I don't have any help of any description. And we're getting on in years, as you can see. And answering the same questions all day, every day, and nobody to run anything past. That was the toughest part. The shed was just then the place for me.
I think people would really understand when you say it was something to do for yourself. Mm. Can you explain that just a little bit more?
I always loved crafts and I always loved women's groups. To just sit down with somebody who doesn't want to know your business and who might say, how are you, and they mightn't. And you just talk about the crafts or you talk about anything you want to, and you're not judged. There's no pressure of any description. The first day I went in, I was handed a cup of tea. Someone just handed me a cup of tea and said, find yourself a chair.
So you've got your bird feeder. Are you excited about that?
I'm delighted. Yeah, yes. Looking forward to doing that now.
Yeah.
Really am. One of the things I really enjoyed, I've just made this sensory quilt for Brian. What kept us sane going around in the first lockdown, Brian was really distraught about it all. And we said the rosary going around the garden because we didn't go outside the door at all. So this is the decorative of the rosary, if he ever wants to sit.
The beads.
The beads are the decorative.
Sewn onto the blanket.
These are shells we're set to go on here. We found them in Rosslare and they're absolutely beautiful. They're not like the ordinary shells.
And so he would touch all the various things.
He loves it. And even this morning he was saying, this is lovely.
How have you used the women's sheds to get you through this pandemic?
I think it's vital. I think it's a lifeline. I know it's a lifeline. I thought I was just joining a craft group. And then I realised I was joining a community, a generous community that encouraged us and cared about us, were there for us night and day. One to one, we would say, we would have been lost without it.
Yeah, Brenda there with Kay O'Riordan singing the praises of the Tom Haggart Women's Sheds. And of course, a lot of women's shed and a lot of women's sheds and men's sheds around the country doing great work during the lockdown. Indeed, if your community has a project which is helping people to stay connected, please do let us know. Countrywide@rt.ie. And Brenda might visit you. I was just saying, though, what a great name there, Tom Haggart. What is the most unusual or your most unusually named village that you've ever come across? Tom Haggart certainly tops the list this morning so far. You're listening to Countrywide here on RTE Radio 1.
RTE Radio 1. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing 295,000 readers the latest farming news and the best of rural Ireland weekly.
Now, the issue of live exports of cattle has long been somewhat of a contentious one, particularly in Ireland, from where around 300,000 cattle, including young calves, are live exported annually. Global data from the UN's Food and Agricultural Organization shows that in 2019, 1.8 billion live chickens, pigs, sheep, goats and cattle were moved across borders in the world, with the EU responsible for its estimated upwards on 3/4 of these movements. But now the European Parliament has established a committee of inquiry onto the protection of animals during transport. MEP Billy Kelleher has just become a full member of this committee with full voting rights. The European Parliament Committee is due to report in a year. And Billy Kelleher now joins me, as does Caroline Rowley of Ethical Farming Ireland. Good morning to you both, and thank you very much for joining us. And Billy, I'll begin with you. Is it ominous for the future of live animal exports that this committee has been established?
Well, I mean, this committee is established primarily to look into whether or not the Commission is enforcing the regulations that it set some years ago in regards to animal transport across the European Union, bearing in mind that when you look at the entire of the European Union, some countries have exceptionally high standards and others are very, very poor in maintaining standards or enforcing standards of animal transport. So from that perspective, that's the primary purpose, is to see the inadequacies of the EU Commission's enforcement of its own regulations through the member states. Obviously, in that debate, there's going to be clear views one way or the other on opinions about the principle of animal transport itself. So from an Irish perspective, you know, we have to ensure that we maintain the highest standards, that we protect the integrity of the standards and the investigation of breaches of standards as well, and that we consistently move towards a position where we can scientifically assess the best standards and, you know, ensure that live exports of animals is maintained in a way and provided in a way that doesn't unduly harm the animal during the transport itself.
Yeah, but, go on.
Yes, there is two issues, you see. There is the issue around the enforcement of the regulations that are there, and then what Ireland has to do to ensure that it maintains the highest integrity in our own standards as well.
OK, Caroline, what do you think the focus of this committee should be?
Good morning, Damien. Thank you for having me on the programme. Obviously enforcement is one issue, but, you know, also that there is the, you know, the suffering that these animals endure during the journeys, and, you know, the whole environmental factors as well. You know, why are we shipping live animals all the way around the world when we can ship meat instead? And, you know, with regard to enforcement, obviously, you know, the bulk of the live export from Ireland is unweaned calf. Last year it was around 140,000 unweaned calves exported. And, you know, these calves are between 15 and 21 days old. They're going up to 30 hours with no feed because it's impossible to feed an unweaned calf during transit. They have to be unloaded from the truck because they have to be fed individually because they're dependent on a milk diet. So, you know, and this is a direct breach of the EU regulation on the transport of animals. You know, the regulation clearly states that calves must be fed after a maximum of 19 hours, which isn't happening because they're on the ferry after 19 hours. So, you know, it's impossible to export calves within the regulation and humanely, because obviously it's inhumane to leave a young vulnerable animal that long without any feed.
But it's in nobody's interest, not least the seller or the buyer of the animal, that an animal would be mistreated.
No, I'm not saying they're mistreated. I'm just saying it's impossible to feed them. And, you know, they do suffer, and some of these animals do die on the way. Unfortunately, the department doesn't actually monitor the mortality rate, so I couldn't give you a figure. But I have seen footage and I've seen documents that show that some of the calves do die on the way. It's obvious if you leave a 15-day-old animal, 30 animals, without feed, it's going to suffer.
OK, Billy, can I bring you in there at this point in relation to the travel journey time from Rosslare to Cherbourg? It means the calves are going without water and without feed for lengthy periods of time, according to Caroline.
Well, they shouldn't be going without water because, I mean, they shouldn't be going without water. There is professional water provided on the trucks that are stationary on the boats as they transfer from Rosslare to Cherbourg. I think it's important to put a few things in perspective. There isn't a huge mortality rate, being honest, Caroline, in terms of the transport of animals from Ireland to the Netherlands, for example. In fact, it is exceptionally low. It is point.
It's not recorded, though. So
it's 0.6%. So it's not. The point I'm making is.
Where did you get that figure, Billy?
Yeah, that I'd like is to know
the,
that.
That is the figure that's recorded in terms of the number of animals that leave Rosslare and arrive in their destinations in the Netherlands. And it is logged, which they're obligated to do by the drivers, and there is inspection processes. The point I'm making here is there is no doubt across the European Union there is fundamental breaches of the regulations that we insist on. But from an Irish perspective, we have a significant challenge because we're an island and we have to transport in ferries. But the standards are exceptionally high, Caroline, and I think it would be wrong to say that there is not high standards in terms of the welfare of the animal. The challenge, and the significant challenge, is on the ferry boats themselves. And we are, and Chagas and others are doing an awful lot of research into how we can assist that to ensure that there's no stress placed on the animals while they're actually on the ferry during that period where they can't be fed. But they are watered, they are bedded, and they are having fresh air, and all those standards are maintained right throughout the journey.
It doesn't matter, though. It's a clear breach of the regulation.
I just have to say, like, there has been research done in the Netherlands on this particular issue, and Irish calves arriving in the Netherlands are of the highest quality and the ones that need least intervention after the journeys.
Okay.
And that has been scientifically assessed and studied by universities in the Netherlands because they are interested in the veal trade.
Okay, well, Caroline, can I just put it to you that if we do concentrate on Ireland for a moment, I know this is a European-wide committee that has been set up in the European Parliament, but we're an island nation, so when it comes to exports of live animals, obviously they have to be shipped via the UK or France or whatever. Are you calling for a complete ban on live exports totally?
Okay, so, you know, I think obviously if we suddenly stopped the export overnight, you know, despite the fact that it is in breach of regulations, obviously that could cause welfare issues here because there would be a glut of calves to deal with. So, you know, we're kind of looking for, first of all, the age to be increased to 2 months old because they're a lot better equipped at that age to deal with the journey, and then looking at a phase out because, you know, we can't carry on being dependent on live export. It's unsustainable. It's not a high welfare industry. Obviously, these animals are suffering. And also, you know, like COVID has shown us that, you know, the supply chains, you know, we can't be so dependent on export. Like last year, the volumes decreased by 60,000. So there were 60,000 extra calves to deal with last year. The calf slaughter went up by about 14,000. So the rest of them must have been absorbed into the beef sector. This year, you know, already the calf export volumes are down 60% on last year's volume at this time of year. So, you know, again, the demand just isn't there at the moment. So, you know, what's going to happen to all these calves? We can't carry on being dependent on an industry that is volatile, you know, and public feelings and perceptions are changing. You know, the reason this committee has been set up is because there was a petition submitted to the E-Commission with like over a million signatures. You know, the public do not like this industry.
Okay.
And, you know, we can't carry on ignoring all these issues.
Just when you're talking about sustainability, you know, farmers sometimes they quibble and say, you know, when I'd be talking to them about environmental sustainability, they say sustainability is also about social sustainability and obviously financial sustainability. And this is a trade apparently that's worth 300 to 400 million euros to the sector each year. So it's not to be sniffed at from an economic.
It was 167 million in 2019.
Well, according to Board B figures from last year, it's 300 million or thereabouts.
That's including horse export.
Sorry, Billy. Yeah.
The entire live export is worth 300 to 400 million. We were talking about the unweaned calves primarily, so we're talking about two different.
And we're talking about weanlings and calves. But Billy, just on that, if you ever want to get a straw poll of the political mood music around Europe, you look no further maybe than Brussels or Strasbourg and the makeup of the parliament there. You're a member of the parliament and have been for over a year now or whatever. Is the mood music regarding live animal transport, as Caroline says there, is it shifting in Europe? And what will the consequences of that be for live exports from Ireland?
Well, there is no doubt there is a shift in opinions around animal transport. Primarily, though, the problem here is there's been a catalogue of appalling abuse in some member states, and that has to be accepted. So we do need to ensure that those that are breaching it fundamentally are making no effort to enforce and have no proper systems in place, that they must be brought to book. But in terms of Ireland itself, I mean, it would be wrong for people to think that Ireland is not enforcing regulations. We have higher standards in many cases. For example, the space required on the lorries is more than it is obligated on the regulations that lay down by the European Commission. You know, so we are doing quite a lot. And Chagas and Borbia and others are involved in very detailed scientific research around the whole impact of transport on unweaned calves. So it's not as if we're not conscious, but we are also conscious of the fact that live animal exports are an integral part of Irish agricultural industry. And we do need to ensure that we protect it, but protect the integrity of it as well by ensuring the highest standards possible.
All right. And I'll bring you back in there, Caroline. I'll bring you back in a second, Caroline, on that. But just Minister McConnellogue, by the way, just it should be pointed out, this week has launched Ireland's the first animal welfare strategy, if people want to read about it on the Department of Agriculture website. Before I go back to Caroline, just very quickly, Billy, what's wrong with slaughtering the animals here and exporting the meat?
Well, traditionally, we don't involve ourselves in veal farming in Ireland. It just hasn't been a tradition of the country itself. We also have an increasing dairy population now. It looks like that we will be going to about 10 billion litres in terms of output from the dairy industry. That will mean more cows, more calves. And the idea that you can keep every animal on the island, you know, I don't believe is a sustainable proposition.
Well, your fellow Minister McConnell, or your fellow party colleague there, Minister McConnell-Logue, he's the very one that says we need a mature discussion now on that expansion, which, you know, is obviously contentious as well. You wanted to come back in there, Caroline, but I can also let you respond to that and also just to ask you a question. Would this then, where would this leave us in relation to the transport of animals to third world countries for breeding and to help farmers there?
Well, breeding is a different issue altogether. But, you know, we can export embryo and semen. And, you know, we have to. The problem with the transport to third countries, first of all, these sea journeys, you know, they can spend 2 weeks at sea, these young bulls. These vessels are very old. I've seen some marine survey report recently with one of the vessels. It's full of corrosion. You know, yes, the industry is regulated on paper, but, you know, I've been researching this for 4 or 5 years now. And, you know, I know that the regulations are not, even in Ireland, they're not being adhered to.
What about flying cattle? That would reduce travel journeys to a fraction.
That's just absurd to me, really. You know, you've got to think about the carbon footprint as well as flying animals all around the world, particularly calves. I know that there's going to be trials starting in March, flying calves to Belgium. You know, first of all, again, they're only going to be like, you know, 15 to 21 days old. The biggest stress during transport is the loading and the unloading. So these calves are going to be loaded at the farm or assembly centre. They're going to go to the airport. They're going to be unloaded, loaded onto a plane in crates or pens. They're going to be unloaded at the other end. They're going to have turbulence to deal with, changes in air pressure, excessive noise.
Okay, so that's a no-no from you.
Absolutely. Okay. I just think that's absurd.
All right, Billy, finally and very briefly, where are we with this committee? When will we have a report?
Well, hopefully they'll make a report at the end of the year, but the report, I hope, will stick to the terms of reference, which is to ensure that the European Commission is held to account about its failure to enforce regulations across member states, and that member states will be held to account. But the broader issue, I also hope, will be adjudicated fairly, and not from an ideological view or any other view, but will be looked on from the science. And I think we should wait for Chagas and others to bring forward their detailed analysis of the impact of transport on unweaned calves. Also accepting that we're an island nation and we do have that logistical challenge of getting from Rosslea to Cherbourg, but we have the highest standards, and I don't think people should be, dismissing that lightly.
And as the only Irish member of that committee, will be interesting to gauge the other committee members' response to you as an Irish MEP talking about the importance of live exports to Irish agriculture. I think both of you, though, Caroline Rowley of Ethical Farming Ireland and MEP Billy Kelleher, you're both at one on the issue of holding the EU to account on the issue of animal welfare. And thank you both very much for joining us this morning. We will be back to you on this issue, I'm sure, no doubt, in the future. Now, researchers at NUI Galway, led by Professor Grace McCormack, are making interesting discoveries about the wild Irish honeybee population thanks to the observation of wild honeybee custodians. What are they? They're ordinary people like you and I who happen to live near wild honeybees and are happy to share the observations with the scientific community at NUIG. Now, Lorna Siggins went to meet some custodians, starting with George Tottenham on the family farm in West Clare. But en route to his farm, Lorna and NUI researcher Owen McLaughlin stopped off to observe for themselves a wild honeybee colony in a hollow in the trunk of an old beech tree.
Can you see in there now? This particular place was pointed out to us by George, who said it was initially discovered by a friend of his travelling in this direction to visit him, and who was urgently struck for the need for a bio break. They're in there. You can see the comb. Can you see the comb in there, the white honeycomb in there?
Oh my goodness, I can see it, yeah.
And if you come a little bit closer, you can actually see the bees walking over and back across them.
There's one now
who won't be happy to see us.
Okay, hopefully that's not a scout.
That would be quite typical of a lot of wild bee colonies. We have seen so many in trees in the course of our investigations. They seem to be quite happy there for the moment anyway.
Owen and I continued on to the Tottenhams.
See that guy in the middle, the black and white guy? He hangs out with turkeys all day.
Here George Tottenham told me about his farm.
Yeah, so where we are now is on our farm on the east side of Mount Callan. As a family, we've been here since the mid-1800s. My father had bees here in the 60s and 70s, but that's beehives, but it never really took off for him due to the climate that we have here and the high rainfall on the west coast of Clare. Then last year, I saw that Grace was doing research in relation to native Irish bees, and I was aware of 3 to 4 colonies that we had either in the house or the surrounding of the house. I also had caught a swarm last year from one of the colonies, and I had it in a commercial beehive. So I thought it would be quite interesting to see if they were studied, how the ones in the beehive reacted or compared to the ones that were living in the roof. So that's how I got involved with this study, and I suppose became a custodian.
Sadie Monks also lives in Clare, and like George Tottenham, she has become a custodian on Professor McCormack's wild honeybee project.
I moved here 25 years ago, but I moved to this particular house 20 years ago, and there were bees already in the roof of the house when I arrived, which was a little startling for me. I'd come from Dublin 5 years previously. I wasn't expecting to find bees in the roof, you know. But it was they seemed completely harmless, and they didn't seem to want to come in through the ceiling, so I was happy enough. And they did cause a bit of a problem, but it actually wasn't their fault, Lorna. The boys were very small. My youngest was only a toddler. As they do, they were, you know, himself and his brother were running around the garden barefoot, and I suddenly realised that there was an awful lot of dying bees on the lawn. And it had been, the Varroa had come down and was killing them. And it was really distressing. I was very upset to see it, you know. I couldn't hear them through the roof anymore. I used to be able to hear them through the ceiling. There was a little kind of a low humming noise that you'd hear when they were cooling the nest. And so when they weren't cooling it down, what happened was that the wax that's holding in the honey started to melt. And the honey started dripping through my ceiling. You know, every floorboard in the house was sticky. I just couldn't stop it coming through the roof. In the end, we actually had to take down part of the ceiling, a good 6 foot back. But actually, they arrived back and they came back to my shed and then the neighbour's shed.
The observations of the custodians have contributed to work published by Professor McCormack in the Journal of Apiculture Research.
Native Irish bees are a member of a subspecies called Apis mellifera mellifera that are actually threatened over their distribution range in Europe and are extinct over a lot of their range because people have brought in other bees, non-native bees, for commercial beekeeping. And because of the introduction of varroa, there was a massive crash in the population. In 2016, we wrote an article for the Irish Times, Dick Alstrom, and we had a big reaction to that. And we followed a number of bees over 3 years. and showed that some of these bees were actually surviving in despite the presence of roe and other diseases. And this is really cool for two reasons. One is for beekeepers, if they can have local bees that are adapted to varroa, they don't need to use chemicals. And it's very good for the conservation of our native subspecies because it can live without the help of beekeepers. George's mum actually had reported in to the first round two of the colonies. One of them has been here for 20 years, so he remembers it as a kid. So that's really why we're monitoring them. And people like George, who knows what he's talking about, can tell me hand on heart, he has not seen any incoming swarms in these years. All he sees are outgoing swarms. And that gives us really great confidence that these bees are surviving.
George is now attempting to use local wild honey bees to produce honey for human consumption.
This colony swarmed from the house last summer, very luckily into a bush that was about 8 metres high. So myself and a friend got a front loader and a tractor, got up, cut down half my mother's bush to get the colony out. We then secured the colony and I put it into the hive here. As you can see where we're standing, this hive is under a old turf shed. So there's a roof over it. The hive itself is dry, so we don't have that issue with moisture or dampness. I learnt my beekeeping last year off Google and reading a Haynes manual on how to become a beekeeper. So I'm not saying this is all scientifically going to work. But what is lovely about it is where I'm standing now, I can look directly in a straight line, I'd say 40 metres to where this colony originally started. So I know it can survive in this climate, in a natural environment. Now, it's as I mentioned, it's the wrong time of year to see bees flying. And also, I know we're on the radio, but it's just started to lash rain here. Yeah. They're not going to really like it if it disturbs them, I don't think. It's quite interesting to have an organic farm in West Clare. And I suppose having a few beehives is another string to our bow and another piece of interest, you know?
And Professor Grace McCormack appreciates the custodians.
Yes, we have at the moment about 40 or 50 people who have agreed to monitor these bees. So I think this could be potentially an amazing citizen science project where citizens are really involved in the research. A thing called Honeybee Watch, an international project. They're trying to do what we've been doing in Ireland. So we're actually leading the way in Ireland, and we already have these custodians, this team involved. And then we can go sample, then we can go study the bees all over the country, from the middle of nowhere here in Iona to in cities. So we've got a lot of urban wild bees as well. And so this will make a good urban and rural citizen science project.
That report there from Lorna Siggins. Thanks, by the way, to Helen Doyle in Wexford, who texted in to say that Tom Haggart is the ancient name that can be traced back 1,100 years and means monastic house. We've had a few other favourite names of places and villages. Mickey Two Taylors Bridge in northeast Clare. We've had Ding Dong in Texas and Knockagilty in County Wicklow, and another place called Calfstown in County Kildare, appropriate for the programme this morning. John the Bull Hayes, good morning to you.
Morning, Debian.
The rugby is back this weekend. You're looking forward to it, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. This time of the year, it always comes around. And even this year, now it's a strange year and different. It'll be a change from what's been a tough enough all January, I suppose. Looking forward to this now to get us going into the springtime.
Yeah. Now, you're working away there with your Herefords. Life has continued fairly normally for farmers, hasn't it?
Yeah, I suppose it has been the one group of people, you know, that things didn't change a whole lot for, I suppose. Overall, of course, nearly a year now, because you just had to get on and keep doing what you were doing, and you were working from home anyway, and
yeah.
You just had to get on with it. It was something that had to be done, but I suppose it was just tough for people to get away from it, maybe if they wanted to, for holidays or whatever. But yeah. Other than that, it's been a place where it was with space and you could get out and get around, so it wasn't as bad as what maybe tough as it is for other people.
And does it make it easier as a parent of three children as well with homeschooling to have that space?
Oh, definitely, yeah. Both Fiona and I definitely commented that over the year like this. Especially even last year when I started the first through March, April, May, even there was really good weather when they were home. So being able to get out in the back lawn and even out in fields and stuff like that, it made it a lot easier for them than what we would imagine if it was someplace else.
Yeah. What about the match anyway tomorrow? It's going to be played in the Principality Stadium. There's going to be no crowds there. And rugby is one of those sports where the crowd really does matter. But it's going to be unusual with the piped music. What do you think of that?
Yeah,
piped crowd sound, sorry.
The sound, yeah, you've been listening to those on television and stuff there for the last few months, since obviously since it started back up, and it's not going to be the same, you know, for anyone that's been to those places like Edinburgh, Cardiff, Dublin, wherever. You just feel the build-up. It's on the bus even before you get to the ground, before you get to the stadium, you're driving in, the streets are full, so the build-up starts from there, like, so it must be weird driving in on a bus with just empty streets, and you're driving under the stadium, and then you go in, and it's just, it's almost like the captain's run the day you go there on the Friday, the day before, just have to walk around, but now it's actually game day, and then you're going out, like, and just the anthem won't be the same, the atmosphere just, but I suppose the boys have to get used to it now after the last few months, so it'll be different, but it's who adapts to that best, I'd say, will be come out on top.
Well, so home advantage mightn't mean so much, particularly with a very partisan Welsh crowd. It's vital that you win your first game if you have any idea of wanting to win, you know, the Six Nations. First game, winning the opener is very important. How are we going to do tomorrow?
I think we'll be good. Like, you know, I think we're a year into a new coach ourselves now, and Wales didn't have a great year for themselves last year after 2019. They had a great year. They won a Grand Slam, got to a World Cup semi-final, and then 2020 for them with a new coach hasn't been great. So we can definitely go over there. I know we haven't won there since 2013 or whatever, but I think the confidence is in the team. We've got experience, got fellas back, and I think the home crowd not being there for Wales is something that they feed off, because their rugby regions don't traditionally do that well in the Heineken or Pro 14, but Gatland always had them playing well as Wales. They used to turn up for play for them better than they did, but I don't know, are they going to be able to feed off that as much now? So hopefully it's something that we can work on and get this campaign off on a good win tomorrow.
Yeah, and a big focus on both the coaches there, as you say, as well. Anyway, listen, the best of luck. I know the calving will be starting there shortly. Enjoy the game tomorrow. Enjoy the games this afternoon. And regards to Fiona, your wife, and the kids there. Thanks as always, John Hayes, for joining us on the programme. That's all we have time for on Countrywide this week, produced by Eileen Herron. Don't forget, playback after the 9 News here in Radio 1, and Ear to the Ground on RT 1 Television on Thursday at 7 o'clock. Until I talk to you at the same time next week. Bye bye, and thanks for listening.